You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
Now, Simon, you just wrote an article recently called "Do All Iranians Hate the Regime?" That's a complicated question, isn't it?
It is, yes. I think that the title is a little bit of a... It's an exaggeration rather than an accurate expression, that's what I'd say, yeah.
Now, we get kind of two pictures of Iran. One is we see people, often women, all in black, protesting against America and Israel and maybe saying things like death to America and that kind of stuff. And then we also have seen protests in the street, and particularly after the death of Mahsa Amini back in September 2022, a young girl who was said, who was arrested for not wearing her hijab properly, and she died in custody in a very suspicious circumstances. Mm-hmm. And there was big revolt after that. So there's two Irans, aren't there?
I mean, I'd say there are more than two Irans. There's a whole spectrum of Irans between those two positions.
Okay. I was in Iran about 8 years ago. I went on a road trip from Tehran down to Isfahan. And a couple of points. The people were very friendly, and others have commented on this, that they will come up to you in the street and say, "Where are you from? Thank you for visiting our country. Do you like it here?" and so on. And that I got that from a lot of people, and other people who have been there have had the same sort of experience. And the sense is that there are a large number of people, particularly urban people in Iran, who desperately would like to break out of what they're living in, the kind of imprisonment they have, and have more outreach to the West. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a position that many people feel is the case. And certainly, I mean, it's something that's a bit contingent on where you are in the country and again, where you are perhaps in a certain part of the city, for instance. But yes, that's definitely a position that many people do have.
Yeah, well, tell us a bit about the makeup of Iran. It's not all Persian people as such, is it?
No. So I guess what we'd kind of loosely call ethnic Persians make up maybe about just over 50% of the population. But then there are also...
But they are very proud of their heritage, aren't they? The great empire of Persia, they strongly relate to that.
Without wanting to kind of deconstruct Iranian nationalism immediately, there's definitely a sense of being connected to that, the kind of Achaemenid history and so on that goes back, you know, many thousands of years.
What struck me about the place was that they are uncovering new archaeological sites all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the famous one is obviously Persepolis, but also there's sites around there, and there's lots of sites in the east of the country, and so on.
So, can minority groups such as Baha'i or Christians or Sunnis in Iran, can they lead a reasonable life there?
Well, I mean, I think that's contingent on who, like, you'd have to break it down depending on which group you're talking about. So I'd say for Baha'is, absolutely not. The situation for Baha'is is truly terrible. And that relates to, I mean, that's not just something that happened under the Islamic Republic, that also happened under the previous imperial regime of the Pahlavis, although it has reached a certain intensity under the Islamic Republic. For Christians, if you are born into an ethnic community where you are understood as being Christian by virtue of your ethnicity, so if you're an Armenian or an Assyrian or something like that, life is not perfect, but you're given sort of constitutional recognition. You know, they have a minority representative in the parliament. There are certain limited freedoms one can have. There's an Armenian club in Tehran where I'm told you can drink alcohol.
Oh, really?
These kind of things. It's quite different, though, if you're a convert to Christianity. So if you are from if you are a Persian, perhaps, and you're born into a Shia Muslim family.
Oh, that'd be frowned on. Yeah.
It's illegal. And many Iranian refugees base their claim for refugee status on the fact that they are converts to particularly Christianity.
Okay. When I was in Isfahan, I met Iranian living in California. Obviously, he'd been very successful in California, and he was visiting the country, and he was Baha'i. And I asked him about the oppression of Baha'i, and he said, it's not too bad. That was about 8 years ago.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to an individual case, and I definitely, when I was in Mashhad, my experience was that people were very uncomfortable talking about the Baha'i faith.
Okay.
I didn't meet anyone who was a Baha'i or who admitted to being a Baha'i. And I guess what I'm going on is the kind of human rights discourse that comes up about the fact that Baha'is in Iran don't have access to higher education, don't have access to any of the kind of basic elements of service that we would understand as being a part of citizenship.
Now, you lived in Iran for a while, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I lived there for about 15 months from 2015 to 2018.
And you learned Farsi in that time?
I did, yes.
That's amazing.
It's a very beautiful language, but it's actually not too complex. It doesn't have any of the kind of tricky genders or cases and so on that make learning so many languages difficult. It's nice and straightforward.
Okay, now looking at the prisons, the Americans and the Israelis have bombed Iran, and the people who hate the regime, and I know some Iranians who absolutely hate the regime, would they have coalesced around the government because they're being attacked from outside? Or do you think that there are people who may take advantage of a situation to see if they can spring about some sort of social change?
I mean, I think it's a very complex question. It's difficult to read the tea leaves on this issue. I think the evidence is definitely the case that some people who have been, I guess what you'd say is the space, the kind of activist space has been kind of split on this issue. So some people have said bombing us is not the way to getting rid of the Islamic Republic. Other people have been absolutely desperate to get Israel and America to continue the bombing of Iran in the hope that the government will be overthrown. I think what we've seen from the government since the bombings is a real crackdown, a further crackdown on dissent in the country. You know, there's been, I just saw the other day in the news, there's been arrests of...
People have been executed.
People have been executed, absolutely. Arrests, I mean, unfortunately, of course, minorities get trapped up in this. And we know, for instance, the small Jewish community that remains in Iran has been a target of kind of particular government scrutiny. So things like that are happening as well, absolutely.
Okay, how have they, the Jewish community in Iran, how have they been able to get by over the years? Has it been awful for them, or the some tolerance of them?
I mean, again, it's a complex question. There's probably about 100,000 or so Jews living in Iran prior to the revolution, and the community now is maybe about 8,000 individuals. So most have left the country. They're kind of based in Tehran, maybe Shiraz and Isfahan. And the community is, again, under a lot of scrutiny. In some ways, though, I mean, life, you know, goes on. And things like, there's kosher butchers in Tehran. There are still functioning synagogues. Though it's schools, those kind of institutions, the Jewish hospital, for instance. But... And I'm not sure quite how this plays out at the moment, but I know until recently it was compulsory that Jewish schools had a Muslim principal, for instance, mm-hmm. or that the manager that most of the staff in the Jewish hospital were Muslims. So some of that's just kind of organic interaction, but some of it's part of that government scrutiny as well.
Okay, so the lesson is that Iran is a complex society, and there's sort of many undercurrents, but I think among the urban Iranians who are very sophisticated, they are well educated, and that includes women who are well educated. They don't think they're allowed to do the sort of humanities that we do here in Australia, but but they often are technicians and engineers and that kind of thing. And so those people seem to me that, from what I understand, are desperate to have some sort of change.
I mean, I think this is quite an interesting point. This has been one of the kind of paradoxes of the revolutionary state, is that it kind of, in some ways, it supported this wholesale movement of people into higher education. But those same people who are now the kind of class of people who make up the biggest government critics. So in some ways, I think the Islamic Republic has kind of sowed the seeds of its own downfall, really.
Yeah, I mean, so they're not like the Taliban in relation to women as far as education is concerned. They clamp down on headdress and that sort of thing. And my experience in Iran was, as soon as women came indoors, they immediately pulled off their scarves. And they would wear scarves at that time, covering just the minimum of the back of the hair. A lot of it was exposed as a kind of defiance. But it's awfully oppressive for them.
I mean, I think, again, that is really a very complex... I mean, I know I've said everything's complex, but that's a particularly complex issue. I traveled with my now wife when I was in Iran, and she was obliged to wear the compulsory headscarf. And we met many people who absolutely loathed it and saw it as symptomatic of everything that was wrong with the regime. We met plenty of people, too, who would have chosen to wear it had there not been the legal compulsion to do so. I think what you say, though, is that most people, regardless of whether they would choose to personally or not, are probably opposed to it being legislated.
Yeah, it is oppressive. When we got on the plane to Turkey, to Istanbul from Tehran, as soon as people got on the plane, the women would take off their headscarves, and then as soon as the plane got out of Iranian airspace, people were allowed to drink. But it was there was kind of the feeling is that of a lot of oppression in social ways. But so just coming to the situation today, it seems to me that the Khamenei, who's been in power since 89, the supreme leader, seems to me still to be, even though he's been humiliated, I guess, in terms of internal Iranian politics, he seems to still be in a strong position.
I mean, look, I don't want to imply that I'm more of an everyday person, but I won't pretend to be a super expert on the political machinations. But I think I don't think there's any clear evidence that the regime is on the brink of collapse. What I would say is I think you're right. They have definitely lost face. And, you know, as those of us who are kind of familiar with cultures in the Middle East and the Islamic world, face is an extremely important thing to keep. And losing that face means the government has to do something.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be a lot of paranoia in the regime because the Mossad have been able to infiltrate all levels, haven't they? And they would... The leadership would be wondering if the person sitting next to them is in fact an agent.
Well, I mean that's truly one of the most extraordinary things about the ongoing conflict in the Middle East since October 7th, 2023, has been the degree to which Israel has penetrated these, you know, its enemies, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iran. Obviously, it is truly extraordinary.
Yeah. So. It's too complex to make any kind of prediction, isn't it?
I'm always hesitant at reading the tea leaves. I think the lesson from the collapse of the Soviet Union has always been that everything looks like it's fine until it's collapsed, and then we say, oh, everything was clear that it was going to collapse after that.
Yeah, so, collapse comes very quickly, doesn't it?
Absolutely, very quickly. We can't know. I mean, my nutshell summary would be that there, in some ways, the Islamic Republic is living on borrowed time.
Yeah. Can I just very briefly then, Khamenei has his kind of Praetorian Guard. That's the Revolutionary Guards, isn't it? There's about 200,000 of them. And then there's the Basij. Can you just tell us a little bit about both of those?
So the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, also called the Sepah in Persian, is this sort of, like you said, this kind of Praetorian Guard that was developed because the Islamic Republic regime was kind of uncomfortable with the level of ideological commitment of the regular Iranian armed forces. So they developed this kind of more ideological military institution in tandem with the... So there's a kind of dual institutionalism there. There's both army and the Revolutionary Guards. They're fiercely loyal to Khamenei, but as I said in my article, and as other anthropologists have kind of pointed out, there is some ideological diversity amongst them. And there are also a whole bunch of kind of pragmatic reasons about why an individual might join. The Basij are the volunteer organization. And again, I knew people when I was in Iran who were members of the Basij. I think that, I mean, they're willing to use violence, that's for sure.
And they do, don't they?
They do, absolutely. But there is also some ideological variation. They're not a uniform. I mean, there are humans at the end of the day. There's always variation.
So the regular army, then, do we know where they are now? Are they ideologically pure as far as the regime's concerned, or are they sus?
I wouldn't say they were sus. They're just not... understood to be the real institution that you could rely on. So all Iranian men go through a kind of a military service period, unless you have some reason to avoid it. And people say, oh, doing your military service sorts the wheat from the chaff, the men from the boys, that kind of thing. A lot of those people serve in on the borders in kind of uncomfortable conditions, but it's the idea that the Revolutionary Guard forms this kind of ideological core, I guess, that's more important.
Okay, so just to finish then, it might be difficult then for regular army people to stage a coup because of the Revolutionary Guards would defend the regime.
I mean, yeah, again, I don't want to predict, but I think the evidence would suggest that it's... if a coup were to come from within Iran, it would actually come from the Revolutionary Guard themselves.
Yeah. Okay. Look, that's been very interesting. Thank you very much, Simon.
No worries. My pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Simon Theobald, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute for Ethics and Society at Notre Dame University. And this is Drive Tuesday. I'll continue with Let It Rain now, Mac Gaydon. Yeah.
You have been listening to Eastside Radio Podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on Podcast.